She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And I have said this so many times on the show before, because of the quality of guests we have and the impact they are making. To me, it's all about the impact. I want to thank our show sponsor, because without the generous support of organization like theirs, there wouldn't be any Mrs. Green's World. So thank you, Fairfax Companies. They are true leaders in the business of sustainability. Thank you for your support of the Mrs. Green's World movement and for everything you do to make our planet more sustainable. So get ready, everybody. And I mean that. I would not be able to fake this. It's like, I love when I have a guest like this. The name of our show today is Business Change Agent. And that is just who and what our guest is. Please join me in welcoming Mal Warwick. And get ready for him to knock your socks off. And I mean that. I did a lot of research, and this is a man that I really want to get to know better. Thank you, Deb Nelson, who was at Social Venture Network for quite some time, for telling me about Mal and what he's doing. So let me share a little bit about you after I welcome you, Mr. Warwick. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
Okay. You ready, everybody? Mal is the co-author with Peter, and as you just told me, Polak, I got it, of the Business Solution to Poverty, designing products and services for 3 billion new customers. It is a winner, 2014 Axiom Business Book. Mal is an author, an entrepreneur, an impact investor, and an activist who reviews books on his blog, Mal Warwick on Books.com, and is one of three partners in One World Play Project, a social enterprise he helped establish in Berkeley, California. And what do? They manufacture and distribute tools for play, including a virtually indestructible soccer ball that never goes flat. You talk about sustainable. Mrs. Green loves that. So, Mal, thank you for saying yes to being on the show, and let's cover some topics and have some fun, okay?
Okay, well, thank you for inviting me.
So I always, you know, I want to sing Let's Start in the Very Beginning, a very good place to start. But there's, to me, I guess why I'm so kind of emotional about this is because of what's going on in our world right now, this minute, the world we're living in, and what people like you who started on a path of service and have done that throughout your life, bringing about really positive social change. How did it start? Where were some of those seeds beginning to sprout? And how did the journey of Mal Warwick begin?
Well, I think if we really go down to the root of things, it was my parents' commitment to and instilling in me a deep sense of justice, wanting to combat injustice in the world. I've never been comfortable with unfairness.
And that's huge. So that's, I mean, the seeds were planted by your parents. And I say that same thing about Mrs. Green's World. And I know that in some of the possible points of discussion, you talked about the Peace Corps. So tell us about that. How did that move you forward, or did it?
Oh, it most certainly did. The Peace Corps was probably the single most important formative experience in my life. I was 24 when I joined the Peace Corps in 1965. I had just dropped out of graduate school, which I found unrewarding. I was sent to Ecuador and spent over 3 years there. So I was actually in the Peace Corps for nearly 4 years. The experience that I had working with Quechua-speaking native Ecuadorians was really quite amazing. And it brought me face to face with the reality that's lived by billions of people around the world, a reality that is constrained by poverty, by racism, and by bureaucratic rigidity.
And the epitome of social, there's social injustice. And I think we live in such a, many Americans live in a kind of, I call it the American myopia. And we'll talk about that a little bit longer. But Ecuador, perfect example. And even now, we're still fighting with indigenous people like the Pachamama Alliance and the Amazon Watch to bring about community organization and stop the devastation of the rainforest, the drilling of oil, and the beat goes on. So I have to ask you, going from your world, what were some of the things that struck you the most about how other people live in the very positive ways? I don't mean, not having a bathroom and all of those things, but the way socially connected tribes live. Even now, it's like some of them haven't even changed that much, Mal, as you know. It's like they're needing to mobilize, but what was your experience then?
Well, very little of my experience in the Peace Corps was with the so-called Indians of the Amazon.
Okay.
Though I did spend about a week down there on one project, most of my experience was in the highlands where Quechua speaking people were virtually imprisoned as serfs on large landholdings. By coincidence, the very day that I arrived in Quito with my group very early in 1966, several progressive colonels in the Ecuadorian army staged a coup. And they proceeded very quickly to pass an agrarian reform law, the first in Ecuador's history, of course. So the tools were there for people in the people who were living under medieval conditions to lift themselves out of poverty. The thing is, though, they had been so beaten down over the centuries that they didn't see the opportunity. And so my colleagues and I, when we started a project working with them about a year after we all had arrived in country, we used a variety of modern teaching techniques to instruct them in the ins and outs of the agrarian reform law. That at length, I am told, though I didn't see it with my own eyes, led to the formation of a national campesino, that's peasant or farmer cooperative, the first native Ecuadorian organization that rose to prominence and helped elect the current president.
And it's almost unfathomable to me to go back to then of what it was like and to be having a part of that and to see. I don't know. It's that's where my journey began. It was in the Amazon rainforest, Mrs. Green. I had this whole social service career and I went there and it can truly be transformative. Now about the Peace Corps, you stayed 4 years. Have you stayed connected and who's, I have friends that retire and join the Peace Corps. So has the makeup of the Peace Corps changed? And it's okay if you don't know that, but to me, it's not a dead organization at all. It's so vibrant and alive and intentional.
Yes, absolutely. Well, as luck would have it, I am on the board of the National Peace Corps Association.
I did not know that. So I'm glad I said all those good things.
It's the Alumni Association of former Peace Corps volunteers and staff. And we're going through a series of monumental changes ourselves at NPCA. But prominent among those is an effort to support Peace Corps' efforts to lobby for additional funding for Peace Corps, to push for policy changes that will benefit serving volunteers and return volunteers, Right now, there are some 7,000 volunteers in 65 countries around the world.
Unbelievable.
Back when I was a volunteer, there were more than twice that number. In Ecuador alone, we had over 300 volunteers. And Ecuador was one of the leading Peace Corps countries for quite a while. So Peace Corps has gone through a lot of changes over the years. It's no longer the freewheeling organization where my friends and I were able to pull the wool over the eyes of the Peace Corps staff and operate pretty much as we wanted to.
You've got somebody watching now?
I think so. I don't think you can get away with what we were doing then. However, I've been back to Ecuador a couple of times, and the volunteers that I met there have the same degree of idealism and dedication to the mission of building friendship across boundaries and helping people to help themselves.
And, you know, just going with my, you know, I said to you that this show, I usually have, you know, 3 pages of questions. I really wanted you to talk more about your, what I feel is the philosophical thread to which you bring everything. And the Peace Corps, in terms of trending and values, I think with the retirement of the baby boomers, so many baby boomers are getting to that age. Who are you targeting? What's the thought leadership around how to grow the Peace Corps back to be healthy and robust? And, you know, from where I sit, it's needed about as much as it has ever been. Does that make sense?
Oh,
so who's
so.
The target? Who would you like to see showing up in record numbers?
Well, I can't say that I'm familiar with the demographics of,
right.
of Peace Corps today, but I can tell you that applications for Peace Corps service are way up. There's something like 5 to 7, I'm not sure the exact number, 5 to 7 applicants for every position open.
So the funding then helps. If there's more funding, there can be more recruiters and more trainers. And I know people are not just sent out to the abyss. In this day and age, that's all I can say. So, so very needed. And to me, think about it, Peace Corps. That's how we build peace. It's the John Lennon song, Imagine. Get more Peace Corps volunteers.
Well, in recent years, a number of 4-star generals have spoken out very aggressively about the importance of the Peace Corps and giving to Peace Corps the credit for accomplishing more that troops can sometimes accomplish in very difficult situations.
And you certainly know that. Well, you don't know, but I believe that. I know you believe that just from reading about your life, and it's so true. They are peacemakers. So let's shift a little bit to, I'm always very consumed with the idea of mission-driven businesses. I hope that all of the businesses I've started have been just that. I wouldn't know how to do anything else. So what does a mission-driven business look like and feel like to you? Give us some examples of people throw that around, and sometimes I roll my eyes and think, well, it's just really not my vision. So what is your vision, Mal Warwick, of a mission-driven business?
Well, I can approach that in two ways. I mean, one, I can name some companies that are well enough known that most of your listeners will be familiar with them.
They better know who they are because they are big ones. Yes.
Stonyfield Farm, Eileen Fisher. I mean, there are dozens and dozens of very prominent national businesses that that consider themselves and should be considered mission-driven businesses. A mission is a commitment to do something above and beyond making profits. In some cases, that simply means that business is dedicated to being fair to all of its stakeholders and not be devoted exclusively to making a profit, to benefiting the shareholders. probably that is the core of the mission-driven business concept, the stakeholder approach to managing a business, where whenever you have to make a business decision, you don't decide it strictly in terms of how much more profit or less profit that it will generate, but rather how it will impact not just the shareholders, but the employees, customers or clients, the suppliers, the community, and the environment. I can't say that it's easy to run a business taking all those factors into account, but it's challenging and very rewarding. And I've tried to do that over the years, running my own businesses. My successors are doing that to this day.
And when you talk about, I mean, it's all of the incorporating the ideas of who the stakeholders are, starting with employees. At SVN, Social Venture Network, which I'd like to talk about in a little bit, I think one of the best presentations I've ever heard in my 65 years on the planet was Paul Saginaw from Zingerman's.
Oh, yes.
And Paul...
He's brilliant.
He was like so awesome, not to mention he had the coolest socks at the conference every day. He ended up sending me a really cool package because there was a lot of healthy food at that conference. And I said, Paul, you know what I wish I had right now? And he said, what? And I said, a Reuben. And he sent me the package that you could get with everything in it, the corned beef and the mustard and the sauerkraut and whatever. He sent a package, but I was stalking him to take pictures for Instagram of his cool socks. But we digress, Gina, Mrs. Greena. What Paul pointed out in very interesting and comprehensive detail is what you said about it is not easy. So
right.
Speak to that a little bit. It isn't easy, but if you do it and commit to it, look at the examples of success, like Paul Saginaw from Zingerman's and his partner's name was Ari.
I think so.
P&A is what I remembered. So tell me about that, the mission, and, you know, my question is some of the challenges that you do have to face and be committed to.
Well, let me give you one concrete example that came up some years back and could be a problem that's confronting lots of businesses these days. Healthcare costs were rising at a very rapid rate, 20-30% per year for long periods. And when I started my consulting business back in 1979, I made a commitment that I would pay 100% of all the healthcare insurance costs for all my employees. And it got to the point after about 15 years or so, 15, 18 years, that the prices were going through the roof.
Right.
And it was becoming extremely difficult for us to continue that and still turn a profit. So that was a dilemma. So I met with my management team, and at length we decided that the way to go was to hold a staff meeting and present the reality to the staff and give them some options. And we came up with several options that involved higher co-pays, for example, somewhat fewer benefits and so
on. Right.
And I can't even remember which option they chose, but the problem was resolved. And that was a decision that was made in the interests of the employees by the employees themselves.
You could not, as far as I'm concerned, picked a better example of what a mission-driven business does in every aspect. And I mean that because when I had my big company, we could have gone out of business because our major payer at the time said their records were so backed up they wouldn't be doing any payments for 2 to 3 months. So we sat down and I said to everybody, I don't have enough cash flow for that. What are we going to do? And if you just ask people, they become part of the solution. People took time off that their husbands wanted them to take a trip. People gave back leave time for, you know, for those that couldn't afford to miss any of their paycheck. People said, I don't have to use mileage. So this is really great and very exciting. Everybody stay here with me. The name of our show is Business Change Agent, and we're getting to talk about one of the most incredible ones I've come across, Mal Warrick. Please stay here with me. Lots more exciting things we'll be covering.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific Time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. The name of our show today is Business Change Agent. Joining us for this hour is Mal Warrick. He is an author, an entrepreneur, an impact investor, an activist, and I would like to add thought leader, who reviews books on his blog, Mal Warrick Books, MalWarrickOnBooks.com, sorry. Mal is also the founder of Mal Warrick Donor Digital, which we're going to talk about. It's a fundraising agency specializing in integrated, multi-channel fundraising and marketing that has served nonprofit organizations nationwide since 1979. The company is a founding B Corporation, which is one of the most exciting things that ever happened to our world, if you ask me, and is now employee-owned, and Mal remains as chair of the board. And I kind of say this to some of my guests, Mal, is sleeping optional in your world? Because I look at everything you're doing, I'm thinking, okay, another man that doesn't sleep, man or woman. So is there sleeping involved in any of your life on a daily basis?
Oh, I'm not that busy.
You're pretty busy, man. And I think I'm busy. I'm like, oh, wow, this is really good. But preserving the planet and driving mission-based organizations, it is definitely a full-time job plus. So is there anything else you want to say about the mission-driven business? I got very excited about the asking the employees, like, what a concept. That is just, to me, it was innate in me. I don't have all the answers. So let's, you know, let's get people on board, and they come up with solutions that not one person can think of. You don't know what their answers are going to be.
Right, right.
I wonder how someone like a Patagonia or a Seventh Generation or a Ben and Jerry's does that. You know, going back to the Zingerman's community, they made a conscious choice to not become the McDonald's of, you know, the corned beef on rye, but they still have 500 plus employees. So how do you do it if you're someone like Patagonia or Ben and Jerry's? Probably you know more about Ben and Jerry's. How do you keep the rights and the best interest, I don't like to say rights, of employees, you know, front and center when you're so big and everywhere?
Well, the first thing that the first prerequisite is you've got to make a lot of money. You have to be very profitable. In order to make it possible to cater not just to the customers, but to the employees, the community, the environment, the suppliers, what have you, as well as the shareholders. There has to be enough money to go around. The crunch comes in usually smaller companies that don't have that much in the way of resources to spread around. That's where the difficult decisions come in. And that's what I confronted over the years on many occasions. There were times when my consulting company, Mal Warrick Donor Digital, was in difficult financial straits. And the only way that I found to cope with that was to, again, to take the employees into my confidence. Fortunately, they were very, very loyal. We had extremely loyal long-term employees for a very long time.
So let's go a little bit, let's carry that a little bit more. You say you have to be, you know, financially secure and successful. But is there a part of this, and I don't know the answer, this is not a loaded question, that if you start, because everybody starts small with that commitment, and an example is 1% for the planet. If you say 1% of my revenue, as opposed to your earnings, which I know some companies that do that, is going to go to X, and it can be a myriad of things, can you grow it in a healthy way by starting out with, okay, this is coming off my profit, my margins right away, I'm going to do X amount. Is there a way to do it and grow big and financially successful, or do you have to wait? That's my question.
Well, you can't do all the things you would like to do. I mean, for example, we would have liked many years ago to install gym facilities, exercise facilities.
Right.
And we were never able to do that because there was never enough money. There hasn't
got
been.
It. Right.
So that, I mean, that's just an example of the limitations. Now, I can probably give you, you know, other examples. But okay, let's talk about the recession. In 2008, we were doing fine. The company was quite profitable in 2008. And then 2009, we got the fallout from the recession. And we started, we got to the point where we were not making any money. We weren't losing money, but there was literally practically nothing in the way of profits. Now, we had posited a number of things on the basis of profits. We had profit sharing, which was quite considerable. It generally amounted to 35% of pre-tax net being divvied up among employees on an equal basis, not according to their salaries, but according to whether they were full-time or not. We had 10% of pre-tax net going into a philanthropic fund to match employee individual contributions. Pardon me?
Employee giving? Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
But the company gave a lot more. The company gave 10% of our pre-tax net. All of a sudden, there's no pre-tax net, or practically none. So we had to really make some changes. Now, at that point, my successor was in place. I was chairing the board, and we made some very difficult decisions to downsize the philanthropic fund from 10% to 5%, and to cut back on the percentage of employee profit sharing. We still had an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan, which meant that employees were still participating in the long run health of the organization, but they weren't getting as much cash in the short run. Now, we could only pull that off and keep employees working for us if we were really straight about the whole thing.
Right.
Just lay it all out for them.
Here's what's going on, and we're bringing you along with us. I mean, just it is very hard decisions when you're at that place where you've got to make some of the tough calls, because as I used to say to the employees, at the end of the day, the truth is the buck stops here, and how can we make sure there's still a buck stopping? And I think this is a perfect segue to talk about the B corporations. I was at Bioneers about a month ago and heard a panel. There was a panel talking about the growth of B Corp, including giants. Like, I remember this, Mal, this guy said, you know, Unilever has approached us about becoming a B Corp. And he said, quite frankly, we don't even know how that could be accomplished. So tell our listeners, share with us, what is a B Corp and why is it so important that people know about it and continuously consider going in that direction? Or is that something you'd recommend? So my first question is, tell us about a B Corp.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, There are a lot of companies that portray themselves as being socially responsible, as supporting right. their community, as being fair to employees, as offering only quality goods. And a lot of that is not true. There's greenwashing that is pretty widespread in the business community. So the B Corporation movement began about 10 years ago as a way to measure and certify companies on the basis of their of the talk that they walked.
Right.
So the three co-founders of B Lab, which is the nonprofit that that administers the B Corp movement, came up with a questionnaire, something close to 200 questions at that time. I think there were 160 questions, and those are very detailed questions about a company's performance with respect to the community, the environment, the employees, the customers, and so forth. Very probing questions, and it was very, very difficult for companies to get even a passing score of 80. This was 80 out of 200, the way we ended up setting up the scale. Some of us did manage to get through very early on and became founding B Corporations. It means that now, as a B Corporation, we can assure our customers, our employees, the community, that we are committed to economic, social, and environmental justice.
And it's really tough to do it. Still, a friend of mine just went through it, and she has a company called Kids Conserve, and she called me. She's based in Phoenix, and she said, like, an IRS audit pales in comparison, or becoming a B Corp, you know, approved. It was rigorous, and she was elated. Yeah. So she took... You know, it's not easy. So you're right. But can you just highlight a little bit about what some of the things they're looking at? Because you said environmental, social, and I didn't write down the other one, but I use it a lot. Justice. It's really very integrated thought, and you can't have one without the other. So what kind of things are they looking for to get certified?
Well, questions about the environmental practices of your company, for example.
Right.
To what extent do you do recycling? To what extent do you, how much do you pollute the environment through your use of plane travel, automobile and truck travel? I mean, do you have commuter system in place? And it goes on and on and on, very specific questions, drilling down to the nitty-gritty practices of day-to-day business.
And I wondered, when this guy presented, how do they get funded? Who supports that? Is there just a fee that people have to pay? It's like, cannot live with myself if I don't go in that direction. Right now, everybody on my team is... 1099. It's the way we've set up because it hasn't worked to have FTE yet. It's 2016, but how can I not do it? So how do they raise capital to be able to do it and certify companies?
Well, yes, companies do pay an annual fee to remain B corporations, and that is a significant. Though not a majority source of support for B Lab, as far as I
right.
know, most of the money comes from philanthropy. There are very large foundation grants.
Love it.
That come from very well-known foundations that want to encourage social and environmental responsibility in the business community. It's that simple.
You know, I have to go out. One of our guests that I just interviewed was, he just impresses the heck out of me. And it's Scott from Charity Water. I've wanted to get him as a guest forever. Uh-huh. And he was talking about the way that their company is set up. And it's unbelievable because 100% of the money that you give to Charity Water goes to the projects they support. And the reason why is because they have a group of philanthropists, donors that pay for all of the administrative structure of Charity Water. I mean, it's out there. So that's an example. And I don't know if, they're a 501c3, and I don't know if they're certified as a B Corp, but if I had known that, I should have asked them. So
no, you can only, your company can only become a B Corporation if it's incorporated.
Okay, I did not know that. So it's not for nonprofits. Okay.
No nonprofits and no LLCs.
Got it. So it's really, okay, so S Corps and C Corps.
That's right.
Wow. Okay, and I didn't know that. It's a beginning journey for me. Rose and Timothy Yee, who I met at the... SVN, man, Rose is all over me saying you've got to become a B Corp. And I said, when I have a little bit more structure and depth, Rose, she'll keep me honest. I can tell you that right now. So
yes.
I want to know from your perspective and many years being involved in socially responsible business, mission driven, whatever, where's your heart and head about trending? Do you think that we're really in a good place where people are going to care more that it's a B Corp? That people are going to care more, that they're supporting a mission-driven business, not where we are, but where I have to believe the movement is going in the right direction. Is that a bubble thought, or is that what you see, having lots of, national and global connections?
That is what I see.
Yes!
First of all, there is documentary evidence of this in the polls and marketing research studies that have been done, which show that consumers increasingly and in large percentages actively seek out companies that treat their employees well and are observant of the challenges of the environment. And this is not just isolated to the United States by any means.
No.
The B Corp movement is worldwide. In fact, a majority of the new B corporations now coming online are from other countries. In fact, the United States has been far behind in some respects in the whole area of socially responsible business. That's been true for many years. England's far ahead of us.
It really is a perfect segue for one of the things I wanted to talk to you about that you briefly mentioned in your notes in terms of things like this, thought leadership and the mindset of Americans in general. And God knows I am so happy that I'm an American. It isn't that. But when you do travel and you do get to go out of the United States, if you're living consciously, your world expands beyond anything you could have ever thought of by staying in, where I was born and raised in West Keensburg, New Jersey. What about Americans? Why don't we teach second languages in every one of our schools? It's like, what's your thought? We'll have to finish it because we're going to take a break in a minute and a half. But I'd love you to talk about not the failure, but maybe the challenges that we face as Americans, not traveling, not really seeing a much bigger world, a global community, and your thoughts on that.
Well, I suspect that the root of the problem lies in our geographical isolation from all but our immediate neighbors.
Right.
We don't have common borders.
Right.
Where
another language is spoken across the street. Yeah.
Right. That is changing with immigration, which I welcome, because we now have many communities where many different languages are spoken. California, in particular, where I live, we have dozens and dozens of languages spoken in the public schools, and I think that's a great thing.
I think it's a great thing, too. We used to be the melting pot, and now we're really the melting pot. So everybody, stay here with me. We're going to go to a quick break, and I'd like to talk to you, now about that a little bit more. And the question I have is, how do we encourage people to travel and make sure that every layer of society gets to do that? And I'm sure you know what I mean. It's not just the people that have the means to go to a trip to Quito. So let's hold that thought. Everybody, please stay here with me. Lots more to share with our business change agent, Mal Warwick. We'll be right back, and there's lots more fun stuff to cover. So don't move.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. The name of our show for this hour is Business Change Agent, and is he ever. Joining us is Mal Warwick. He's an author, entrepreneur, impact investor, and activist who reviews books on his blog, malwarwickonbooks.com. And I want to say a little bit more about him. He is also the co-author of Values Driven Business, How to Change the World, Make Money, and Have Fun. And I love that piece. It's like all of the things that I want to do every day in my life. He co-authored it with Ben Cohen, who is the co-founder of Ben & Jerry's, another really fun person. And that wasn't enough. Along with Cohen and some others, Mal was a co-founder of Business for Social Responsibility that they started in 1992. He served on its board in its inaugural year. And, you know, Mal, I like to go on and on about people who are on the show, most of whom don't care about that part, but it gives some frame of reference for our very, very vital and robust and passionate listeners about where you've been and what you've done. So I like to brag about you because it speaks to credibility from where I sit. So that's why I do go on and gush a little bit. If you don't want gushing, switch to another channel. That's what I tell people because I am showing up as me on Mrs. Green's World Show. So we were talking about, you know, the failure. Why don't more Americans learn foreign languages, travel outside of our comfort zones? And I guess the hidden question for me is, I always talk about the great divide. I could, not coming from a wealthy family, but being able to go on trips and afford the airfare, you know, not a Ritz-Carlton traveler, but I had the ability to pay for it. And so many kids that I've worked with 35 years, they're trying to figure out how to buy a new pair of shoes. So how do we get people to travel so that it's even more of a level playing field instead of increasing the great divide? Does that make sense? I think you know where I'm going with it. How do we make travel possible for all of our citizens?
Well, I'm not sure how we can do that. But I do think that we can begin to introduce some changes to the culture in two ways. One is by promoting the Peace Corps much more vigorously than has been the case over the last half century. And if we can expand the Peace Corps to 10,000, 15,000, 20,000 volunteers at any given time, that will start to have a real impact. I believe that with over 200,000 alumni already, that we have already made something of a dent, but clearly not enough. Another thing that I think we can do and should do is to encourage a gap year travel for high school graduates. There's a whole host of programs. I've worked a little bit with one called Global Citizen Year, which is based out here in Oakland. And they do a marvelous job of picking very high potential high school graduates, training them, supervising them very rigorously, and sending them overseas for nearly a year so that they come back much better prepared, much more mature, and in position to benefit from their college studies. I think that gap year education is a big part of the answer.
And for people that don't know what that is, in like I know, especially in the UK, I'm not sure about Germany. I lived in Germany, but not there. Kids go away for an entire year, and talk about the growth. And it's such a win-win-win because it gives kids a little bit more of a chance to grow up and decide and open their world. I mean, there's just no downside. That's an amazing, there's thought leadership. That's why I gush about you, Mal, because it's like, yeah, let's do the gap year and promote the growth of the Peace Corps. And, you know, I have to always give a shout out when things like this come up to Rotary. I've been in Rotary for 23 years. For 20 of them, we did the youth exchange. And it was funded by Rotary. Kids come living in our homes, but more importantly, our kids got to go. One of my daughters went to Ecuador, and another one went to Argentina. And you know what? Mm-hmm. It was really hard for them, but changed their lives, like totally changed their lives, especially my youngest one. I mean, it changed the trajectory of her life forever by living. She actually lived, after she got out of college, she went back and lived in Argentina for 18 months. Your world is never the same if you get to really see other parts of it.
There's no question about that. A couple of years ago, I sat down with the, I think there were 67 or so new fellows for Global Citizen Year, during their training, before they left for their assignments overseas. They were high school kids, you know. They were 17, 18 years old. They all seemed to be bright, but, you know, there was nothing really exceptional that jumped out at me about them. I saw them later. It was like 7 or 8 months later after they returned to the United States. They were totally transformed. These were mature young adults. They had grown up. They'd seen the way the other half lives around the world. They were no longer so naive about America's role in the world.
It's one of the kids, you know, as part of Rotary, we sponsored a third grade class at the highest risk school in Tucson, and we all committed to mentoring them for a year. And there was, of course, a hardcore group of us, about 15, that are still in touch with our mentees, as we call them. We've grown up with them. That was, you know, they're 27 now, and they were in third grade. And we got, this is to me about the great divide, we got to get some of those kids to go on exchange programs. Believe me, they didn't come from a population where their moms and dads were in Rotary. So we went, really worked in their communities with their parents, and one of our kids went to India. I mean, he said, Gina, I'm from South Tucson. I had never even been to the airport, let alone flying to India, and he'll never be the same. Never.
I'm sure.
And I think I went to India for a year, I probably would never be the same either. I mean, but it was transformative. And then he comes back and it has an impact on his family and his younger brothers and sisters. So bring back the Peace Corps and the gap. I mean, I wonder what our chances are, but what a great idea. Okay, we don't have a lot of time left. I knew it was going to happen, and I'm enjoying myself maybe a little bit too much, if that's possible. But I'd like to talk a little bit about Donor Digital and the One World Play Project. And if we have time, the great vision and impact that Social Venture Network is having. So in the next 10 minutes, you think you can cover all those, Mal?
I don't know.
Give justice to a little of them, like One World Play Project, why it matters. And it so matters. It's not just a soccer ball. it's a life-changing possibility for kids, if you ask me, but I'm asking you.
Yes. The ball was designed by Timothy Yonagan, an inventor and musician here in Berkeley, to meet the needs of kids in war zones, in refugee camps, in poor villages, in low-income inner cities, that would substitute for the handmade objects that they put together out of trash. They couldn't afford soccer balls. Even if somebody came in and gave them a standard soccer ball, it would be punctured and useless within a very short period of time, an hour, a day, a week, a month. So this ball, which is virtually indestructible, is a gift of amazing proportions for poor children in very difficult situations around the world. We were fortunate enough very early in our existence as a company to be contacted by General Motors. General Motors marketing people wanted to associate Chevrolet worldwide with soccer. And so they lined up a sponsorship with Manchester United, the most popular soccer team in the world, far, far greater than anything in American sports, 700 million fans. And in addition, they wanted something more down to earth, and they found us. It took over a year, almost a year and a half, to negotiate and sign a contract. But once we did, they committed to paying for us to manufacture and distribute 1.5 million One World footballs over the course of 3 years. Now, that three-year period was up in July, and yes, we did distribute 1.5 million balls. They went to over 175 countries, and by the calculations of other people, not ours, other people who are familiar with sports and recreation in neighborhoods like the places where we went, that those balls, those 1.5 million balls, benefit 45 million children.
It's just the pebble in the pond on steroids.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It really is. And just having that joy, some of the specials you see, you know, it looks like kick the can instead of soccer, because kids will make soccer balls out of anything. So it's just, I mean, that is it's monumental. And again, from the American perspective, which, you know, soccer is growing here in this country. It's another thing that's trending upwards and in the right direction. But we have no idea. I mean, it is the sport in almost every place else in the world.
Oh, by far. There are at least 2 billion soccer fans. And I mean soccer fans. People who
I watch some of those soccer teams. Matches. They're serious about their soccer.
Yes, they are. And the soccer players are paid even more than American sports stars.
You know, which is the biggest a big number.
Soccer. It's a very big number. So it's huge. Now, at One World Play Project, we've begun manufacturing other products as well. We have a cricket ball, and to everybody's surprise, I'm sure, cricket is the number 2 sport in the world.
You are kidding me.
Number 2, way more popular than basketball, baseball, or football, or American football. Way more popular.
So here's the ignorant American. I didn't know that. Mel, you're kidding me.
Cricket is very, very popular in South Asia. In India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, there's a population of over 1.5 billion people. They're all cricket crazy. So forget the rest of the former British Commonwealth.
Right.
There's an enormous fan base for cricket.
And, you know, the numbers are staggering. We have to remember that one out of every two people on the planet is not an American. It's more like, I think you sent me something that said one out of 20. So there are lots of others, not Americans.
We're 5% of the world's population,
and yet speaks volumes about what kind of power and respect we have garnered in some cases. So let's not go off on that tangent. I would like to talk more about Donor Digital. We have about 5 minutes left, and I think it's really important that you share about Donor Digital. Very important work with nonprofits.
Well, Donor Digital is one of two companies that we recently merged to form what is now awkwardly called Mal Warwick Donor Digital.
I'm good
Mal
with
Warwick
that.
Mal Warwick & Associates was the company I founded in 1979. And I co-founded Donor Digital to take on work in online fundraising through email and websites and later through social media. I co-founded that company in 1999, and then about 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, we bought it back from my partner, and we now have merged the two companies. So that's how we can present a wide range of services to nonprofit organizations in fundraising,
and give them tools that can help, like, ensure their sustainability. Because to me, when I did hours and hours of reading about you since I got turned on by Deb Nelson, and it's fun. It's fun to look at what you're up to. I am fashion myself as a thought leader as well. I mean, who starts a radio show at, I was 57 after 35 years in social services? A nut job is what I say sometimes, but it's like, I want to tell the stories of people like you, or have you tell them. So it's wonderful to be helping the nonprofits and giving them real tools to ensure that their important missions go on. So kudos to you. We really don't have time to talk about SVN, Social Venture Network, because to me, what they're doing with their bridge program, you know, I've had so many guests on that it just comes up and they said, oh yeah, I was a part of the bridge program. Young, exciting, on-purpose entrepreneurs that have no idea how to take their oyster mushroom and scale it. They're just selling it to, you know, but that's one of the, I've had Ari on. And, Social Venture Network helped me. So it's maybe that's another show when we start Saturdays with Mal instead of Tuesdays with Maury. Okay, this is what I want to ask you in the several minutes that are left. There's 2 minutes. What call to action would you say to someone that's listening? We have thousands and thousands of listeners. When they get off the show and they're listening to this, their podcast is finished, what would you like them to feel inspired to do? If there was one or two things that just do this.
That's a tough one.
Because you have so many things you're doing.
Well, it's difficult to imagine what everybody might do. I mean, I could certainly advise business people what they might do, but you know, people in general, it's hard to know. I mean, from my perspective, what is most significant about the world and about our lives is that we as Americans lack a genuine appreciation of what is going on in the world. So I think that paying more attention to news from other countries, learning foreign languages,
love it,
could in the long run make a lot of difference.
And what you're talking about, I don't think you could have said anything better. It's about awareness. Start raising your awareness. Yeah. Read about the Peace Corps. Google you. Look at Mal's on books. I mean, there are so many things, but it all starts with awareness. So pick an issue and start learning it. And I thank you for taking this hour to be with us. Coming up, we have two great shows to end up the year. Scott Harrison from Charity Water and Sephora Berman, who wrote the book, This Crazy Time, Living Our Environmental Challenge. Loved her. Mal Warwick, keep on doing what you're doing, and thanks for showing up in Mrs. Green's world.
Thank you very much.
Okay, make it a great green week, everybody.